You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. When social activist Paul Kivel first wrote Uprooting Racism over 20 years ago, the unrest in the wake of the Rodney King beating and verdict was fresh in his mind, and he wanted white Americans to recognize their role in helping to make our culture a place of greater equal opportunity, or to recognize their place of privilege in our society at a time when white privilege was not a part of the American vocabulary. Now, over 20 years later, he's updated his book, Uprooting Racism, How White People Can Work for Racial Justice. And in an era of Black Lives Matter and where hands up, don't shoot is the mantra that reminds us we're still not far as a culture from when Kivel first wrote his book, his guide is a sincere attempt to promote equal opportunity, democracy, and justice in highly polarized times. Paul Kivel is an award-winning author and the co-founder of the Oakland Men's Project, a community education center focusing on preventing male violence. He's been a social justice activist, a nationally and internationally recognized anti-racism educator, and an innovative leader in violence prevention for over 40 years. Paul Kivel, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
You first wrote this book, I guess, over 20 years ago. I'm thinking about 20 years ago. This would have been
in the middle of the Clinton administration.
Right, exactly. When, again, we were still talking about race then, and now you've updated it here in a fourth edition. I'm sure you look back at the progress, the lack of progress. Are our racial divisions worse today, about the same, or any better?
It's really difficult to make those kinds of judgments. Back in the mid-90s, we were in a period where people were saying we had a post-racial society, and the civil rights movement had taken care of all that. Then Obama was elected president in 2008, and people were saying, that's proof that we're post-racial, that with a black president, what else could we do? And yet the levels of racism in our schools and healthcare and job markets and housing markets are devastating to our community. The evidence is stark. And today we have a president in the White House whose rhetoric and policy is explicitly racist, turning our attention to blame recent immigrants and Muslims and others for our problems. At the same time, we have cell phone videotapes of police murdering unarmed black people. We have Black Lives Matter or Standing Rock, Fight for 15. We have lots of resistance, a lot of people of color organizing and naming the conditions we live in. And yet, at the same time, we're still a majority of white people when polled say that racism is not a major problem in our society and that it's certainly not happening in their community. So we go back and forth, and people of color are constantly bringing our attention to the devastating impacts of racism, not only in their lives, but on our entire society. And yet there's just not enough of us who are white who are stepping up to really working with them for racial justice.
In your book, you say we're sort of in our third phase of racism. The first was a naked aggression, which involved the expansion of the United States at the expense of Native Americans. The second phase was what we would think of as the Reconstruction era and Jim Crow laws, apartheid, if you will. And now you say we're in our third phase of racism, which seems to be more an economic and political form. How would you describe that?
The word that a lot of people use is neoliberalism. I think that first, just to add to that, it wasn't just the theft of land and genocide against Native Americans, but it was the whole system of slavery.
True.
That built the economy of both the South and the North. So after the decolonial struggles of the 50s and 60s, and after the civil rights gains that were made in the 60s, we eliminated legal racism in the sense that it was no longer written into the laws explicitly, and people around the world eliminated the ability to, they won their independence, and we were no longer to control them directly. So we had to have more subtle ways to do that. And so neoliberalism is a policy of the ruling class, a set of policies to retain ruling class power and wealth, but to do it in a way that doesn't explicitly name racism as an issue and pretends or claims that we live in a post-racial society. And that means that, just as always, racism is used by the ruling class to split and divide us, like it was in colonial Virginia, you know, 300 years ago. But today, rather than talking about the tremendous concentration of wealth in our country, our attention is directed toward recent immigrants and Muslims and people of color in our communities and so on. You know, today there are three white Christian men in this country who control as much wealth as the entire bottom half of the U.S. population. That means that 160 million people in the U.S. have as much wealth as those three men. And that's a tremendous inequality, and it has devastating impacts in our community, because that concentration of wealth lowers our wages, pulls money out of our public systems, and is basically based on the exploitation of all of us.
Let me ask you, that idea that you're talking about, this income inequality, and it's the 1% sort of keeping the rest of the 99% in check, that's not explicitly racist, because it keeps lower classes, it has an effect on them as well. But I guess what you're getting at is they exploit racial divisions.
Exactly. Poor and working class and even middle class white people are definitely paying the cost of this inequality of wealth. We see it in our schools. We see it in the lack of health care, the number of homeless people, the number of people who are out of work. But the racism is partly that people of color are exploited at the very bottom to even greater extent than most white people, and that racism is used to divide us from our natural allies in working for a fair and equitable and just society.
Earlier you were talking about the impact of amateur video documenting of incidences. How has this changed? You know, I mean, this is a new thing since you wrote your last version of Uprooting Racism. How has this changed how we react to stories of governmental use of its forces to using it against a various class of citizen?
I think it's been a really significant change, because it chips away at the denial that so many of us who are white participate in, the denial and minimization about the real impact of racism. And it allows us to understand that we live in very segregated society. Most white people live in housing that's segregated, go to schools that are segregated, go to churches that are segregated. And therefore, we don't have much direct connection with people of color, nor do we understand very well what they really experience. And these cell phone videos, the alternative media, has been so important in breaking down that lack of understanding.
When you say that we have segregated again, a lot of people will say, well, that's been a voluntary segregation. But would you say that actually there's been some unseen hands at work in encouraging segregation?
Absolutely. It's been not just personal choice, but public policy in many areas. First of all, the land was cleared of Native Americans to make it safe for white people. So many of our areas started out as white because of that violence and dispossession. But then there's a lot of areas that were sundown towns in which people of color could not stay or live or stay overnight. There's a lot of history of housing policies, redlining, and various other forms of discrimination that have kept people of color out of neighborhoods or forced them out if they were able to move in. So if we're white and we're in an all-white space, whether it's a meeting or a neighborhood or a workplace, we have to ask ourselves, how did it become white? Because there was a process there. There was a history to that process of making it only white. Because we live in a very diverse society, but not everybody has the same opportunities to move around or to live in different kinds of spaces or participate in different kinds of organizations.
My question was, I guess it sort of took that as a given, but those policies no longer officially exist. You know, the idea of redlining, of sundown towns, of all the things that you mentioned. those don't officially exist, but there are a lot of unseen hands that sort of still encourage that.
Right. And one of those is just what we've traditionally called white flight. When people of color start moving into a neighborhood, sometimes it's not that they are prohibited from moving in, but that white people leave and move further out into the suburbs or move back into inner city areas that are being gentrified, in which people of color are being dispossessed. So there's lots of different mechanisms that get used. And like you said, not as many legal ones, because explicit racial discrimination is not legal in most places. But at the same time, there's lots of other ways that we tend to recreate white space and marginalize people of color.
My guest today is Paul Kivel. He is a writer, educator, and activist, co-founder of the Oakland Men's Project. His book, Uprooting Racism, How White People Can Work for Racial Justice, is published by New Society Publishers in a new fourth edition. His first version of this book was published over 20 years ago, and he's just updated it in a fourth edition. What are the first steps in uprooting racism?
I think that for those of us who are white, some of the first steps are, one is that we don't know very much about how racism really operates, because our textbooks, our schools give us a very distorted version of U.S. history. The media that we watch and listen to often has, you know, negative portrayals, stereotypes, some misinformation about people of color. So one first step, and one of the reasons I wrote my book, is we need a lot more information just about how racism works in our society and how it impacts us, how it impacts people of color. How do we benefit from it, and what are the costs to us from it? The second thing that we have to do is that because racism holds up white people as the heroes and builders of our country and our communities, we tend to have a sense of entitlement and privilege and superiority over people of color. And so we have to look at some of the ways we've been socialized and unlearn those attitudes, because we can't be working with people of color in a powerful and useful way if we carry in to those relationships these attitudes of entitlement and superiority. And then the other place I think we need to start is we need to break the silence in white communities. Silence is a form of complicity. It's a way we collude with the status quo and support racism. And we're not very good at talking about racism in white spaces. If we talk about it, we tend to do it with coded language. But in terms of explicitly talking about naming, trying to understand more about racism, we're very, very cautious. We're very scared often that we'll make a mistake or that somebody will be hurt or will be uncomfortable. And therefore, we're not good at breaking the silence in our families, talking with our kids, talking with neighbors, coworkers, people in the community. And yet, we're not going to be able to actually address racism effectively if we can't talk about it.
So let's talk about that first step, getting a sense of a better sense of our history and how whites benefit and are harmed by racism. What are some of the ways in which most people may be unaware of how they benefit and are harmed by racism?
It's really important for us to understand both the benefits and harms that racism does to us as white people. Think about who made your clothes. Think about who made your cell phone and computer. Think about who grew the food that you had this morning or processed it or cooked it or served it. Who cleans some of our public buildings? Who takes care of our elderly in nursing homes? Our lives are completely interdependent with the lives of people of color who are doing work that benefits us. Mostly very low-wage work, often invisible, and often very dangerous work. And yet we claim that, well, racism is somebody else's problem, but we're sitting here in our daily lives benefiting enormously from the things that racism produces, which is exploited workers. At the same time, we have to acknowledge that for most of us who are white, we don't have a lot of benefits, because those benefits have been concentrated at the top of the economic pyramid. And that's what we were talking about before. The concentration of wealth means that we get the trickle-down benefits and not the main benefits of power and wealth that accumulate at the top.
Right. We're saving maybe $5 on this shirt I'm wearing because it was made in Southeast Asia as opposed to the United States by unionized workers. But the owners of the capital of the company are making a lot more.
Right. The owners of the Walmart family have billions and billions of dollars made both from our patterns of consumption and the exploitation of workers around the world. So, again, one of the costs to racism is we don't see our natural allies, and because we are told to mistrust and fear people of color.
Now, a lot of people would say that that's a case of economics, not necessarily race. How would you respond?
It's both, and I think part of the problem is that often when we start talking about race, people either say, well, it's really economics, or if we talk about economics, they say, well, it's not. That's not about race, it's just about economics. But they're incredibly intertwined. The country's economy was built on the backs of stolen land and enslaved labor. And that's racial and it's economic.
You know, and when people, I'm sure some people, when they hear that, they say, that's going back 150 years or 200 years. Is it important to keep that timeline in mind as you address these issues today?
It's important that we understand those historical processes because that legacy lives on today and is continued. We are still exploiting people of color who make a lot less, work at a lot more inferior jobs and in more dangerous working conditions. And so it's not like racism is over. And so we need to understand the history because we're living the legacy of the history. And until we come to grips with that, we're still going to be putting up Civil War statues and honoring a past that is a false representation of what really was happening.
Talk a little bit about the harms from racism to white people.
Well, besides the one I mentioned about the way it divides us, what does it say about us, our individual integrity, when we live lives that are benefiting from the exploitation of other people? It certainly damages our sense of integrity and our sense of honor in our families and communities. We also are locked out from the creativity, the contributions, the ideas, the tremendous energy that people of color bring and could bring even more to our society because we live such segregated lives. We also, I think it damages us in a really deep spiritual way to be living in a society that is based upon injustice and exploitation and violence. So I think that on many levels, the segregation, the violence, the exploitation damages our sense of ourselves, the integrity with which we can raise our kids, and keeps us locked into a pattern where we're thinking, well, it's their problem, it's happening to them, and it's not our problem. And the other thing that is really true is that nothing stays in somewhere else in somewhere else's community. When toxic waste is dumped into communities of color, that's our air and our water. And when we look at the struggle of Standing Rock, for instance, they were protecting the water not just on their land, but for the millions of people lower down the river that could be impacted by oil spills. We have to understand our interdependence with people, I think.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that keeps popping up in your book quite a bit is the idea of fear and the use of fear as a trigger to trigger racial divides. Can you talk a little bit about how fear is used? I think a lot of times that fear is used in political divides. If you're fearful, you tend to become more protective. I mean, conservative not in the political sense, just conservative in a personal sense, a conserving your, you know, what you have.
I think that that's very true. We've seen that there's been a tremendous criminalization of people of color in our society, particularly black and brown people. And we live in a system of mass incarceration. Now, what that has done is not only been devastating to communities of color, but the stereotypes and the media portrayal of people of color as criminals, as dangerous, has made us want to support politicians who build more prisons and don't address the actual economic problems that we face, as just one example. Also, we're taught to fear people of color in other countries who are labeled terrorists, when in fact we have a lot of white people. Every day we're hearing about new acts of terrorism and mass killing in the U.S. by white people. And so we have to look at where is the real danger, not where are we directed to be fearful because of the interests of people with more power and wealth than we have.
Yeah, I guess you're referring to the idea that if a white person goes into a institution and commits a mass shooting, we refer to that as a deranged individual. If it's a person of color, our first thought is it's a terrorist act.
Exactly. And we don't even use the word terrorist very often to apply to white people. It's a racialized term.
But beyond fear, you talk a lot about geography, and I assume that's the geography of separation, of lack of understanding, because groups are divided from one another.
That's an important piece of it. It's also true that those spaces are policed so that some people feel safe and some people don't. So often white people claim that they feel unsafe in communities of color, even though that those of us who are in communities of color don't find the particularly high levels of danger. But certainly true that for people of color in white communities, and we often say, well, my neighborhood's safe, and yet a person of color walks through and they're immediately racially profiled and pulled over and, you know, pressured to leave. So there's a geography of fear that has very much to do with who we are racially. And of course, gender and sexual identity and sexual orientation are other factors that have a lot to do with safety and geography.
One of the things that is happening now is you mentioned the Civil War statues. There seems to be a reckoning of our history of what those statues actually represent, and a reassessment and a willingness, at least from some governments, to say, yes, they don't stand for what is commonly used to defend the existence of those statues. You're also seeing things like the Me Too movement and a reckoning of gender relations. Do you think this will have a positive effect on racial relations, or will it actually exacerbate it down the road?
I think that any time we start to seriously address issues of violence and exploitation and marginalization, we're making some progress. All of the issues are interconnected. And the Me Too movement was started by an African-American woman, and it's a lot of strong leadership from women of color in that movement. I think that that's one of the things that's really important about dealing with racial justice and any issue, is that we can't separate it from class, from gender, from ability, from lots of different things, because we don't live separate lives. We live with lots of different identities, and they're interconnected.
My guest today is Paul Kivel. He's a writer, educator, and activist, a co-founder of the Oakland Men's Project, and he is the author of Uprooting Racism, How White People Can Work for Racial Justice. It's out in its new fourth edition, and it's published by New Society, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. In our last couple of minutes, can I ask you to talk a little bit about that third idea, big idea that you talked about, breaking silence in white communities? How important is it for us to speak up, whether it's an inappropriate joke, if it's an incident in our community which doesn't directly affect us, but it affects those around us? Can you talk about breaking silence in white communities?
Breaking silence, I think, is an essential piece of the work that we have as white people. I can ask most white people, what do you stand for? And they'll say they stand for racial justice. But if I ask them, who do you stand with? In other words, who are you showing up for? How are you involved? How are you practicing being an ally? Most people would pause and have to really seriously think and realize that they really they may stand for racial justice, but they're not doing anything about racial justice.
Well, oftentimes we might even talk about it, but we don't do anything.
Exactly. And so we need to seriously look at what are the ways that we can take our whiteness, our benefits, our position, and leverage that into working for racial justice. A few years ago, some of us started a national organization called SURGE, Showing Up for Racial Justice. And we now have 175 chapters around the country. And those chapters are focused on educating and mobilizing white people to show up in multiracial alliance with people of color to work for racial justice. And I think the work starts when we actually take that first step and interrupt a conversation or a joke or a question of policy at our workplace, or show up in the community when there's a act of police brutality or a housing situation. There's just so many ways that we can be doing this work. But we talked about the preliminary steps, but the preliminary steps have to lead to the active steps, or we may believe that racial justice would be a good thing, but we're not actually doing anything to create the kind of world that we want to live in.
You know, there are a lot of issues, everything from, again, police justice to DACA to all sorts of events, and we may sympathize, but that first step of actually participating is difficult. What would you suggest to those people that want to do that, but haven't made the step?
I would suggest, first of all, having the conversations, raising race as an issue, in your conversations, in your family, in your neighborhood, and school, and things like that. And then looking around where you are. We are all connected to neighborhoods and communities and cities or rural areas. We're all connected to healthcare systems. We all are connected to workplaces. And we need to start asking the questions. Why are people paid differently for doing comparable work? Why are some people marginalized in our organizations? Why are some people getting inferior service or being surveilled and monitored and treated differently than other people? We need to be asking those questions and then getting together with other people to figure out ways to address that.
The name of the book is Uprooting Racism. Paul Kivel, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. I wrote the book as a toolkit for people who want to get involved, because I know so many of us who are white are uncomfortable, are upset about what's going on in the country, and want to find ways to make a difference. And the book has histories, stories, ideas, guidelines, questions, and many different ways to help people take that next step and get involved in working for racial justice.
Well, Paul, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Writer, social justice activist, and educator Paul Kivel speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His book, Uprooting Racism, How White People Can Work for Racial Justice, is out in its fourth edition, published by New Society Publishers. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.